Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Greg Bowman, and he is speaking on the subject of Shakespeare's family values. So let's listen in on Greg.
If you think it is early days and clear out bag and baggage, if you think it is high time and that is the long and the short of it, if you believe that the game is up and that truth will out, even if it all involves your own flesh and blood, if you lie low till the crack of doom because you suspect foul play, if you have your teeth set on edge at one fell swoop without rhyme or reason, then to give the devil his due, if truth were known, for surely you have a tongue in your head, you are quoting Shakespeare. If you bid me good riddance and send me packing, if you wish I were dead as a doornail, if you think I am an eyesore, a laughingstock, the devil incarnate, a stony-hearted villain, bloody-minded, or a blinking idiot, then, by Jove, O Lord, tut tut, for goodness sake, what the dickens, butt me no butts, it's all one to me, for you are quoting Shakespeare. Well, as this example illustrates, most of us are capable of quoting Shakespeare without even realizing it. How convenient. There really is no bigger, I think, currently cultural icon in our lives than Shakespeare. Shakespeare is just so huge. A sign of erudition that if you wanted to show yourself to be educated, you go to Shakespeare and quote him. I'm not necessarily sure that this is a good thing, but it seems to be the current state of our culture. So much so that as this example illustrates, that even in our very language, in the language that we use that has been passed down to us, we have familiar phrases that are from Shakespeare, and many of them, you know, as I first read this, I was thinking, as well as I know Shakespeare, good grief, is that actually in the plays? And it sent me to my concordance to find out exactly where, and yes, indeed, it is in there somewhere. The reason I bring this up, the fact that Shakespeare is such a big cultural icon, is that his reputation would seem to be, at least with conservative America, would seem to be standard. And yet, I'm not so sure that people know exactly what is in Shakespeare, and would, if they thought about exactly what Shakespeare was trying to teach us, if they might not have the same problems that have arisen with current Hollywood, with current polemics against Hollywood. I like to think of when I came across the recent Bob Dole speech against Hollywood and Time Warner in particular. I immediately thought about Shakespeare and his time, because Shakespeare lived in a time when playwriting, and specifically the types of plays that he was writing, was not looked upon very, very highly in some circles. In fact, the theater throughout this period had a real tenuous time in maintaining its place in society. There was a lot of people, especially in the government, who thought that the theaters needed to be closed. And as, let me give you the dates too, as history has borne out, they were actually closed. In 1576, this was the date when Shakespeare wasn't in the theater at the time, but one of Shakespeare's semi-contemporaries lived a little bit beforehand. He opened the first theater in the London area, and it was called, amazingly enough, the Theater. This was the first permanent structure that they had to do plays in. Until then, most of the people who were performing in inn yards, in various places across the country. They had no permanent structure, and as a result, they would attract mobs, and it wasn't a pretty sight, and there were laws that were passed against this type of behavior, and so that they decided, well, if they're not going to let us perform in the inn yards, we're going to have to build our own theater. And Richard Burbage's father, James Burbage, then built the theater in 1576 as a permanent structure to perform plays. This is usually the beginning date that we think of the Renaissance playwriting era, when Shakespeare's plays were written. The ending date is usually fastened at 1642, and this is when the Puritans succeeded in closing the theaters. They had decided that playwriting was an activity that they really didn't like, they frowned upon it, and they decided to close the theater. So in between this time, you can see this is where Shakespeare lived. Elizabeth I, her reign ended when she died in 1603, and James I, who is also James VI of Scotland, reigned from 1603 to 1625. Those were the two rulers that essentially were during the time of Shakespeare. After James's son Charles was the one who was executed and that led to the Restoration, or the time in between the kings and the Restoration later on in 1660. So this is essentially the time frame that we're talking about, 400 years ago. Now, the attitude towards playing at the time, there were a lot of polemics against playing and what they didn't like. First of all, they didn't like the crowds. This was a time in London when there was lots of plagues, diseases. They didn't like the fact that there was crowds. And there's also the typical mob distractions that go along with crowds. And, you know, there were fights that would break out in the yards, in the play yards. There were fights even that would break out among the actors. Ben Jonson, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare's, was arrested and would have been executed if he didn't have the ability to read and write. He claimed the benefit of clergy. He would have been executed for a duel that he had with a fellow actor named Gabriel Harvey. So these people couldn't get along. There was also in the yards, they were afraid of traffic problems, if you can believe that. Somebody complained about all these carriages that were lined up and to take people home and whatnot. They also complained that this was an activity that took apprentices away from their work. Now, I'm not so sure that this is true. Some people have done some studies recently that have shown that the typical apprentice probably couldn't have afforded the play price, even if it only was a penny to get into the gallery. It also cost 3 pennies to cross the Thames. And so 3 pennies plus 1 penny plus 3 pennies back, 7 pennies, that would be probably about 1/10 of their weekly wages. So they may or may not have been a lot of apprentices attending the skipping work and attending the plays, but at least it provided an opportunity for people who wanted to close the theaters to complain. You know, this is idle activity that people shouldn't be engaged in. They played, by the way, because there were no lights. They played during the daylight, so it was between the hours, usually at between two and five. They would play, and it was an open-air theater, so the sun would be shining, and if the weather was nice, they'd run the flag up the flagpole to let everybody know on this side and on that side of London that there was a play that day, and then people would come, and usually it was during the day, so if they had work, they'd come, they'd skip their work, and then they would leave. Another complaint about plays at the time, and so far we haven't gotten anything into the content of the plays, but one of the complaints about plays at the time was that there was cross-dressing going on. All of the women's parts were played by boys in women's clothing, and this was just, especially to the Puritans. When I first studied Shakespeare, I was told, you know, you got to suspend your disbelief. Everybody thought of the boys as being women, you know, and they were comfortable with the fact. Well, you look at some of the letters and some of the comments about playing at the time, and people were not comfortable with the fact. This is one of the things that if they wanted to close the theaters, it was a good reason to close them. People were uncomfortable with this idea of men or boys being dressed up in women's clothing. As for the content of the plays, in order to get your play to be produced, you had to submit it to a censor. And it was one guy through this whole period that Shakespeare was writing. It was the same guy who would look through every single book, and he would cross out passages that he found offensive, or he would strike out whole scenes, or he would reject a book or a plot entirely if it had anything offensive in it. So there was a lot of censorship going on, and it's amazing that what they wrote actually got through the censors. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a plot device. I can't, unfortunately, because you know the title of the session, I can't keep secret the author's name, but I just want you to suppose that this is a young screenwriter proposing a plot for Hollywood, and I want you to think if this is the type of plot that you think that Time Warner would produce and would be approved on and that the players would go. I'll keep the title to myself. Those of you who are probably more familiar with Shakespeare might know this, but I'm betting that this is a plot that some of you are less familiar with. Even in the supreme hour of his triumph, this is a brief synopsis, even in the supreme hour of his triumph, as he receives the acclamations of the cheering Roman populace upon his return from the Gothic Wars, a victorious general mourns the death of his 21 sons, and revengefully demands a fiery sacrifice to appease their souls, the eldest son of the conquered queen of the Goths. The general returns, his sons have been slain, and he wants, as a sacrifice for his slain sons, the eldest son of the queen of his enemies. Now the queen tearfully pleads for her eldest son's life, but to no avail. He demands, the general demands the sacrifice and kills the eldest son. Well, his 21 sons are buried, and then the general returns to affairs of state. He is offered the Roman crown, and he upholds in strict justice the claim of one Saturninus, who is the eldest son of the late emperor. So far, this is above board. The late emperor's son should become the next emperor. And so he correctly turns down the crown. Through the general's influence, the treacherous Saturninus ascends the throne and offers to wed the general's daughter, Lavinia, even though the Gothic queen has already caught the fancy of the new emperor. Bassanius, who is the brother to the emperor, wrathfully declares that Lavinia is betrothed to him, and with the support of Lavinia's brothers, the general's sons, abducts and marries her. Enraged at this open breach of faith, the new emperor, Titus, starts in pursuit of his daughter. Enraged at the open breach of faith to the new emperor, the general starts in pursuit of his daughter and finds his way blocked by one of his sons. He kills him. All right, now this is in the first act. We've already had the queen of the enemy's son being killed and the general killing his own son. And it gets worse. During a royal hunt in the forest, Aaron, who is one of the emperor's henchmen, hears that Tamora's evil son's other two sons, Chiron and Demetrius, are quarreling over the prospect of possessing Lavinia, whom they both desire, and he incites the bestial pair to ravish her in turn and to ensure secrecy by tearing out her tongue and cutting off her hands. Okay, straying through the wood while the hunt is in progress, Bassanius and Lavinia discover the love affair of the queen of the Goths and Aaron, the henchman, and fearing their disclosure, Tamora calls her sons, telling them that her brother-in-law and his wife have insulted her and threatened her with torture. The sons kill Bassanius, throwing him into a deep pit, and drag Lavinia away to defilement and mutilation. As Lavinia begs them for death. She would rather have death than this type of mutilation. Aaron, the henchman, inciting two of Titus' sons into the pit, in which they fall upon Bassanius' body, quickly summons Saturninus, points to the young man struggling to escape, and produces a falsely incriminating letter arranging for the plot for the payment of the murder, and discloses a bag of gold which he had previously placed near the spot. Okay, now this is scene two. We've gotten through the first two scenes, and already the couple people's sons have been killed. And then there's this whole plot with the rape, and then they cut off her tongue, cut off her hands to make sure that she doesn't disclose. They kill her betrothed, and then they blamed the general's other two sons for this, and now the other two sons are about to be executed. Well, now it's the general's turn to plea for his son's life, and he says that he will be willing to give up his hand for their son's life, for his two sons' life. And this offer is accepted, so Aaron the henchman then cuts off his hand and takes it away, and then brings back the hand with the two heads and says, essentially, ha ha. Now we're through scene three. They vow a terrible requital, and one son, whom the emperor has just banished, is instructed to raise another army among the invading Goths. Lavinia contrives to fasten their crime of banishment and mutilation on Chiron and Demetrius by turning to the pages of Ovid's Metamorphoses with the stumps of her arms until she reaches the tragic tale of Philomela, and with a staff in her mouth and guided by her arms, writes in the sand the names of her assaulters. Pretending to be mad, Titus sends presents to Chiron and Demetrius and shoots arrows into the Roman streets and palace, all of which bear messages to the gods proclaiming his wrongs. And it still gets worse. Meanwhile, Tamora gives birth to a black child. Aaron the henchman, by the way, is a Moor. Tamora gives birth to a black child, of which Aaron is the father, and her sons try to kill it, but Aaron takes possession of it and kills the nurse and midwife to prevent gossip. Has a white baby substituted in the child's place as the emperor's son. Taking the infant away to be brought up by the Goths, Aaron is captured by a soldier in the army of Lucius and exultingly relates this to the general the full story of his crimes after extracting a promise for his child's protection. Saturninus, knowing the popularity of Lucius, is greatly disturbed when news reaches him of the huge forces drawn near the city, and he endeavors to arrange a banquet and parley at Titus's house, where Tamora will separate the general from his army and stir up enmity between them. And here's the final scene. Shakespeare, by the way, in all good dramatists of the fashion, begins the play with a stage strewn with rushes and ends the play with a stage strewn with corpses. To win the support of the supposedly insane Titus, Tamora goes to him disguised as Revenge, stating that her great desire is to avenge his wrongs at the banquet, and Titus promises to send for Lucius. She returns in glee to the emperor to make ready for the feast, leaving her two sons at the home of the general. He has them overpowered, cuts their throats, as Lavinia holds a basin to catch their blood, and grinding their bodies to a pulp, bakes it into a pie, which in the costume of a cook, he serves to Tamora, their mother. Titus informs Saturninus of the crime of Chiron and Demetrius and tells Tamora that she has just eaten their bodies in the pie. He then kills Lavinia, his daughter, to put an end to her shame, then stabs Tamora. Saturninus kills the general and is himself killed by the general's one remaining son, who then tells the Roman people the complete story of his father's tragedy and is proclaimed emperor. Aaron is condemned to death by torture. End of play. Gosh. And this is even more gruesome when you see it being produced, because a lot of the killings occur on stage. It was one of the gimmicks of the period to see just exactly what you can get away with on stage, what sort of theatrical stagecraft spectacles you can get away with. And so you have the chopping off of the hand on stage, you know, and I'm sure they have a false hand in front there. You have the stabbing of people. You have you don't have the cutting off of the heads, although I imagine if they could have figured out a way to do that, they would have. But lots of blood, as long as there's stuff running out. The people whose throats are slit, that's done on stage. I've seen the BBC production of this, and they actually add an element to that. Lavinia, of course, is with her stumps holding this bowl. And the Chiron and Demetrius are hanging upside down, so that when they cut the throats, then the blood is dripping into this bowl, and the added effect that the BBC production adds is that then Lavinia takes the bowl and then drinks it. Gruesome stuff. Would this plot fly? I mean, could you make a Hollywood movie out of this? But this is the story. This is the story of Titus Andronicus. This is the name of the play. I gave away the title. I kept saying Titus. I was trying not to. But this is the story of Titus Andronicus, which Shakespeare was writing probably around the time of 1594-1595. If you want to judge about how old Shakespeare is at the time, you can look at me. I was born in 1964, 400 years later. This is 1995. So I'm about 31, so Shakespeare would have been about my age when he's writing this. You know, 31, good age for a Hollywood screenwriter trying to get into to the Time Warner Company and get his work produced. I can just imagine what the reaction to this is. This is about as gruesome as Shakespeare gets, but yet this is Shakespeare. This is the cultural icon that I've been describing at the beginning. Any comments so far about, you know, feel free to jump in.
Wasn't the context of their time, though, much more violent? Maybe that makes us think that things have moved somewhat in over the centuries, that this kind of violence maybe would be more appalling to us than, of course, it's set in an earlier time too than Shakespeare's time, but.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I do agree with you that at the context of the time, I mean, death was certainly an everyday occurrence. You just couldn't avoid it. The plagues were so widespread, and the stench of some things were unbearable. They had some customs. Elizabeth I, when she died in 1603, she died in March, and I can't remember the exact date, but I do know that it was over a month and several days later in April when they buried her. And between March and April, that whole month, she laid in state in open view. And I can just imagine, there's one description that they had to put a red wig on her as she laid in state, and that you could see the maggots as they were crawling in and out of this wig. And this is the queen of the country, you know. But they were certainly more used to death. I'm not so sure that they were used to violence. They did have public hangings, and they did have a practice called drawing and quartering, which is very gruesome. But on the other hand, you know, they probably had never heard of the term of a drive-by shooting, or experienced a culture that has seen a lot of drug use, has seen a lot of violence. I mean, while death has not been as personal to us, and you know, we've seemed to have isolated the death process to a point where people die in hospitals and doctors see it more often than family. And this has been a change in within our, I'd say, a couple of generations ago, you would actually see people die. But I in my own life have not seen a person die. And this is some part of our culture. You know, we see it on the screens. We may see it in TV, but we experience it less in person than they would.
But I think women and children were not seen as equal, and so they were property. And certainly there was a feeling of the first son and people wanting that not to happen, but I think women and children's lives were more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very, very, very true. The frontispiece, by the way, and this is my dad's copy of Shakespeare, 1936 edition. The frontispiece of this play, I'm surprised, is the act of ravishment. I don't know if you can see it.
Raphael Kent.
I'm sorry?
Who's the artist? Is it Raphael Kent?
That's a good question. See if I can. Yes, Rockwell Kent.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Well, I mean, he's famous for doing this style of, but he's fairly contemporary. You know,
mm-hmm. Of doing this style, yeah,
the style of illustration, and mm-hmm. His Shakespeare is, he's one of the famous illustrators of all the Shakespearean plays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just find it amazing that they pick the act of ravishment as the central focus to this play. And as the one that they want to, when they only have one illustration per play, this is the one that they pick.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's not just. I mean, it's also an editorial decision.
Yeah.
You know, to pick that. This is the Cambridge edition, edited by William Aldous Wright. So the editorial decision to pick that and that particular illustration to
You know, this too kind of leads to many parallels in history where. It gets to a point where the Puritans were able to close the theater and so forth, and right now we're going through mm-hmm. maybe looking at some things again in society where at least there are certain groups that would like to kind of close down the theater again
mm-hmm.
and start over. It's interesting, you know, the Puritan thing was there, the Victorian era, these things happen.
Yeah, and
you get to a point where it's shut down again.
Where you want to say enough.
And society said enough.
Mm-hmm.
But your letters and criticisms, that one of what you said when you stated the criticisms of the time, didn't mention the violence. I mean, what you said in the beginning.
The violence of the plays wasn't part of the criticism.
Things like that, but it wasn't the violence at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or was it?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, they were upset by more moral issues, but to them the violence wasn't a moral issue. I have a feeling that the general Titus killing his daughter to prevent her shame would have been looked upon as a righteous act. Mm-hmm. And it's something that maybe with our modern sensibilities we look at and we'd say, you know, I can't believe this. You know, this is hard to understand.
It's somewhat the same today. I mean, Bob Dole, in his speech, did not condemn Arnold Schwarzenegger or Bruce Willis, mm-hmm. staunch Republicans. And that kind of violence is acceptable. Mm-hmm. The comic book violence, mm-hmm. this is almost comic book violence.
Yeah, as opposed to the more realistic violence or you know, it's... I don't know if he mentioned Pulp Fiction, but that would be, I think, something that would fall under the Dole polemic as something that shouldn't be out there because it's too realistic. It's too close to what might actually happen rather than the comic book violence of Schwarzenegger with the huge gun just spraying nameless bad guys. Go ahead.
What was I'm sorry, maybe I've said something about this before I came in, but what was what's the rationale behind many of these plays having males in women's parts? I mean, was there a protective quality there? Was it because it was too gymnastic? I mean, do you have any sense of what's behind that besides just...
Other than the fact that this was a craft and they were the apprentices,
yeah.
It's the same thing as why you didn't have women learning the craft of printing, learning the craft of tailoring,
or singing in the choir. For that
right.
matter. But I just thought maybe they had some kind of a Puritan view that this was not something that a woman should do because of the. Issues that were in the play or the violence. I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've never read it. I can't remember ever reading anything about that.
But. Yeah, I don't know. The idea of women as actors didn't occur until after the Restoration.
Yeah.
But I think it was more of a trade issue than the contents of the plays themselves. I want to go on and talk just a little bit more about Titus Andronicus and give you some flavor of some of the attitudes that there are. One of the things that people say about Shakespeare is that at least if there's something bad happening, there's some resolution at the end. Characters either repent or are punished, or a combination of both. The ending of Titus Andronicus is a little bit problematic in that respect because the one of the main villains, Aaron, the Moor. This is his final speech, which is the second to the last of the play. Those of you, I've passed out some copies, if you can find a copy of the play. Second to the last speech of Titus Andronicus has Aaron, after he's received his punishment, which is essentially to let him be set breast deep in earth and famish him, there let him stand and rave and cry for food. If anyone relieves or pities him for the offense, he dies. This is our doom. Some stay to see him fastened in the earth. Aaron responds, "Why should wrath be mute and fury dumb? I am no baby I, that with base prayers I should repent the evils I have done. 10,000 worse than ever yet I did would I perform, if I might have my will. If one good deed in all my life I did, I do repent it from my very soul." So you get the act of repentance, but instead he's repenting the one good deed that he may have done with all his... he does repent it with his very soul. You could say that there is some resolution because the final speech then is given to Lucius, who of course then brings the play to some close. Let me point you to another play, again problematic. This one's Troilus and Cressida.
Well, that ending though, I mean,
go ahead.
He's so very bad that there's no one that can, probably no one at that time that would say, well, let's just give him life imprisonment or something. It's like he obviously, everyone would want to see him die after mm-hmm. a speech like that. So
yes.
It kind of relieves the conscience, perhaps.
Yes, and sort of points us to his desert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look at the ending of Troilus and Cressida, which in some books, I don't know, if the blue copies at least are separated by histories, comedies, tragedies. It's hard to know exactly where to put this. This is in some respects a history. It's sometimes put as a comedy because the central idea is a love story. Sometimes it's put as a tragedy. It's really hard to characterize. Most recently it's been characterized as a satire, but there aren't too many other Shakespeare plays in that category, and so it's hard to know what to do with. The final speech in this play is given to Pandarus. Pandarus, who... like his name might indicate, is the pander between Troilus and Cressida. He's the bawd that brings Troilus together with Cressida. And this is not exactly a positive character. And this is his final speech. Troilus dismisses him by saying, "Hence, broker lackey, ignominy and shame pursue thy life, and live I with thy name." Essentially, he's banishing him to a life of his name. Pandarus responds, "A goodly medicine for my aching bones. Oh, world, world, world. Thus is the poor agent despised. Oh, traitors and bawds, how earnestly are you set to work, and how ill requited. Why should our endeavor be so loved, and the performance so loathed?" What verse for it? What instance for it? Let me see. And he quotes here, "Full merrily the humble bee doth sing till he hath lost his honey and his sting. And being once subdued in armored tail, sweet honey and sweet notes together fail." And he goes on, "Good traders in the flesh, set this in your painted clothes." And he quotes again, "As many as be here of Pander's Hall, your eyes half out, weep at Pander's fall. Or if you cannot weep, yet give some groans, though not for me, yet for your aching bones. Brethren and sisters of the hold door trade," hold door, holding the door open between the forechamber and the bedchamber. "Brethren and sisters of the hold door trade, some 2 months hence, my will shall here be made. It should be now, but that my fear is this, of Winchester would hiss. Till then, I'll sweat and seek about for eases, and at that time, bequeath you my diseases." And that's the end of the play. You know, gosh, would this fly? Could you leave?
Hollywood doesn't like those kinds of endings.
I'm sorry?
I don't think Hollywood likes those kinds of endings.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I don't think moviegoers like that kind of endings either. You know, and I'm not sure that Shakespeare's audience would have liked this kind of ending. This was not a popular play in Shakespeare's time. From the diaries that we have of what plays were performed, how often, this was not one of them. This was not one of Shakespeare's most popular plays. But here it is again, a play by Shakespeare with this ending that I'm not sure I would feel comfortable with, or I would want, you know, disseminated in our culture. Comments on this? No? Well, let me give you some more examples. The beginning of Romeo and Juliet. I read Romeo and Juliet when I was in the eighth grade. This is a common first play of Shakespeare. And it still is common. I believe it still is. Anybody here a high school or a junior high teacher? Is this still read in the junior high schools?
Romeo and Juliet, and then Julius Caesar too, in junior high schools.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Romeo and Juliet, it seems to me, is probably seemingly more accessible to younger people because it deals with a theme that they are encouraged by. And also, the characters were, you know, teachers used like to explain, the characters were your age. You know, Juliet is supposedly 13, 14 years old, and Romeo not much older. I lost the page in this edition. I'll go to my other edition. But the opening to Romeo and Juliet, if I could have a volunteer to read this with me. This is the two servants who begin the play, and I'm sure the scene might be familiar to you. Can I have somebody read? Okay. Are you familiar with the scene? Do you know what goes on?
No.
I'll even give you your own text if I can find the copy in here. Do you see it? Here it is, 313. Now I'm switching gears here. I'm going from a discussion of violence to a discussion of sex, essentially. Eric Partridge in the 1930s, 40s came out with a book called Shakespeare's Body, in which he said, it's there. We've just been ignoring it all these years, but it is there. Let me point this out to you. And I'm going to give you a familiar scene. This is the opening of Romeo and Juliet, something that is read in junior highs. And I want you to listen for every single possible double entendre that is in this speech, because they're all there, and yes, they do mean what you might think that they mean. Okay? Do you want Samson or do you want Gregory? I should be Gregory, because my name is Gregory.
Okay. Gregory, on my word, will not carry a coal.
No, for then we shall be colliers.
I mean, and we be in collar, we'll draw.
Aye, while you live, draw your neck out of a collar.
I strike quickly, being moved.
But thou art not quickly moved to strike.
A dog of the house of Montague moves me.
Well, to move is to stir, and to be valiant is to stand. Therefore, if thou art moved, thou runnest away.
A dog of that house shall move me to stand. I will take the wall of any man or maid of Montague's.
That shows thee a weak slave, for weakness, the weakest goes to a wall.
'Tis true. And therefore women, being the weaker vessels, are ever thrust to the wall.
Say that again.
And therefore women, being the weaker vessels, are ever thrust to the wall. Therefore I will push Montague's men from the wall and thrust his maids to the wall.
The quarrel is between our masters and us their men.
'Tis all one. I will show myself a tyrant. When I have fought with the men, I will be cruel with the maids. I will cut off their heads.
The heads of the maids?
Aye, the heads of the maids, or their maidenheads. Take it in what sense thou wilt.
Well, they must take it in the sense that feel it.
Me they should feel while I am able to stand. And 'tis known I am a pretty piece of flesh.
'Tis well thou art not fish. If thou hadst, thou hadst been a poor John. Draw thy tool. Here comes two of the house of Montagues.
My naked weapon is out. Quarrel, I will back thee.
How? Turn thy back and run?
Fear me not.
No, Mary, I fear thee.
Let us take the law of our sides. Let them begin.
Okay, and then they get into a quarrel with the Montagues that come along. Did you catch some of the things in there? we can even emphasize this even more. I mean, some of these lines, thank you. But, your naked tool is out, huh? Some of these lines, while they need footnotes, some of them don't. But when he says, you know, 'tis well thou art not a fish, if thou hadst, thou hadst been a poor John. Fish was a slang term for a woman. You know, 'tis well thou art not a fish, if thou hadst, thou hadst been a poor John. Draw thy tool, here comes two of the house of Montagues. My naked weapon is out, quarrel, I will back thee. Okay, all of these have double entendres. And I can just imagine, you know, the Renaissance audience who is more familiar with the language, I mean, they would just think this is hilarious, you know, all of this banter back and forth. You know, is it any wonder that playing and theater going in this time was just thought, you know, oh, geez, what are we teaching our youth? What sorts of things are being corrupted? Or how are we corrupting them? And I can't help but think today, too, if we teach this play, you know, how do you avoid this? I'm, you know, it's not that obscure. You can find it in the footnotes. And is this the type of thing that we want to be reading in the eighth grade? What do you think?
I don't know. I think it probably is fitting for eighth grade.
You think so?
Yeah. There's
that their level of humor.
I think their level of humor is about right there. And the groundling humor was that. That's exactly who Shakespeare was appealing to the groundlings. But if I'm not mistaken, I taught school for quite a number of years. Those pieces are not in the text. They have a marvelous way of editing out all kinds of scenes to cut it down to size.
Do they? Do they really do?
Yeah,
that?
And they do that also with. There was a wonderful text that had mythology in it in junior high, and there's something about the myths that just bring out every animal instinct. It's wonderful. So they had this expurgated text. And the kids still got it. I mean, you can
really?
Just tell
them. That's funny. I guess I do know that they do that. I read The Diary of Anne Frank when I was in the eighth grade, and then I read it again when I was overseas, and this was I was a junior in college at the time. And the version that I had as a junior in college, I was thinking, I don't remember any of this being in there in the original version. And I went back and I checked, and it wasn't. They had cut out a lot of parts. But it seems to me, you know, I don't know if this is appropriate or not. You know, on the one hand, I can think that kids this age are wrestling with these types of issues, but on the other hand, you just wonder exactly if this is the dole complaint. You know, what are we exposing our children to? You have to wonder if the same thing would apply to Hollywood, if it would not also apply to Shakespeare.
Well, this again is in context of what you're teaching as a teacher. You teach a context, like I teach Antigone for values. In the Greek, you know, it's a very messy tragedy. But if you get into values of government versus individual rights to do things, and you teach it in total context, I think there's value there when you take out those little segments like you just did. And then the public sees just that piece on the news. Well, yeah, like our folks right now, they're standing in the doorway.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
When you mentioned, you know, the public sees those segments on the news, that reminded me, when this whole thing came out, all of the networks were replaying Dole's speech over and over and over again, and in the background, they would show clips, some of the worst clips from these movies, especially, what was the Oliver Stone movie?
Vietnam?
No. Natural Born Killers, the most recent one, which is, it's essentially about how media, has anybody seen that movie? No? Well, this is Oliver Stone, who's won two Academy Awards, presented this movie as sort of a satire on society and the way that they uphold public figures or media figures as heroes. Here are two people who went on a killing rampage and are arrested, and they become cult heroes in the movie. You know, people just love them. They can't get enough of them. And for Oliver Stone, this was a real biting satire on the way that the media can elevate people, especially condemnable people, to a heroic stature. And this was just lambasted by Dole as being an example, because he shows all of this violence, and essentially he's created a media cult figure about this movie that he was choosing to satirize. This film has just been lambasted by Dole. But at any rate, when they were replaying parts of Dole's speech on the networks, they would replay it over a backdrop of showing clips from this particular movie, especially clips of random gun violence and that type of thing. And it seemed to me that this was just exacerbating the problem. You know what I'm saying? If they wanted to sort of set themselves back and claim, you know, we're just reporting the news, this would be not a good example, because in some sense they were perpetuating precisely what Bob Dole was trying to say.
Well, it's like your example from Torkelson Cressida, you know, that last speech certainly is something else, but most of Torkelson Cressida is just very funny. It's very satirical, and it's fun. And mm-hmm. It's not innocuous in any way. It's not offensive. It's just an mm-hmm. interesting tell. So that one part, taken out of context, you say, well, this whole play is trash, but it's not real.
Yes and no, except that the scene just before the end of Troilus and Cressida has Achilles killing Hector in a very, very nasty way. Achilles, who is supposedly the greatest of the Greek heroes, comes upon Hector, who is really the moral center of the play, unarmed, and this can be played up wonderfully on stage, you know, coming across a person who is weary from battle, has taken off his armor, has discarded his shield, has discarded his sword, and sits there resting from battle, and then his enemy Achilles comes upon him. And Hector says, I will fight you, let me get my armor on. And Achilles says, you know, no way. He kills him and shamelessly kills him, and then says, now let it be proclaimed how I killed him in such high battle. And then we get the ending with Pandarus. So, yeah. You know, I'm not so sure that it's all fun and games.
No, but I mean, it's mild, and it's certainly not anything that most of the play is not, it's kind of satirical. It's mm-hmm. very funny as we're watching how these great Greek heroes are brought to this human level, just mm-hmm. as Achilles is brought to a human level. He was really a joke. He wasn't much of anything.
Mm-hmm. Right, and Nestor being this old man who's senile and Thersites, who's the clown, the satirical voice of the play, he says the whole Trojan War is basically over a whore and a cuckold. Yeah. And he sort of reduces this mythological thing into that one short phrase. I have one more scene that I want to get through. And this is from Measure for Measure, which I had the good fortune of seeing last time that we went to Stratford. This is a marvelous, marvelous play, again, about a society that you just don't know what to do with. Could I enlist your services again? You're on page 908 here.
Is it going to be like the last one?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
this time I'll let you play the straight character. You can read the parts like Aeschylus. I need one more character to, or one more volunteer to read. Does somebody else have a copy of this? Or Luke, do you want to come up and read a couple lines? No. Can somebody read just a couple more lines? Oh, sure. Thank you. You can borrow my copy up here. For those of you who have copies, and I've passed out a few, I wish I could have brought more, but these are heavy books. I can't bring them from home up the boat as easily as I could. We are in Measure for Measure. This is Act 1, Scene 2. No, I'm sorry. This is Act 2, Scene 1. 1, 2, 2, 1. It's all one.
Whereabouts?
Okay. It's my line 195. Where were you born, friend? Here in Vienna. Are you 4 pounds a year? Right here.
Right. Okay. Who's who?
Okay. If you could read Aeschylus, you can.
Mine
read
doesn't have stuff numbered like that, so.
Froth. Yeah, we'll just start with mine. Yeah. This is Master Froth. I am Pompey, and he is Aeschylus. He is a. He's essentially an official of this town that has shown all the signs of moral decay. And this official is going to various people. He's coming to a person who frequents the bawd houses, and that's Hans. And he also goes to a person who runs the bawd houses, and that's me. And I'm sorry, your name is?
Matt.
Matt is playing the official that is questioning these people. Okay, where were you born, friend?
Okay. Where were you born, friend?
Here in Vienna, sir.
Are you a four score pounds a year?
Yes, and please you, sir.
So, what trade are you of, sir?
A tapster, a poor widow's tapster.
Your mistress's name?
Mistress Overdone.
Has she had any more than one husband?
9, sir. Overdone by the last.
9? Come hither to me, Mr. Froth. Master Froth, I would not have you acquainted with tapsters. They will draw you, Master Froth, and you will hang them. Get you gone and let me hear no more of you.
I thank your worship. For mine own part, I never come into any room in a tap house, but I'm drawn in.
Well, no more of it, Master Froth. Farewell. Come you hither to me, Master Tapster. What's your name, Master Tapster?
Pompey.
What else?
Bum, sir.
Troth, and your bum is the greatest thing about you. So that in the beastliest sense, you are Pompey the Great. Pompey, you are partly a bawd, Pompey. Howsoever you color it in being a tapster, are you not? Come, tell me true. It shall be the better for you.
Truly, sir, I am a poor fellow that would live.
How would you live, Pompey? By being a bawd? What do you think of the trade, Pompey? Is it a lawful trade?
If the law would allow it, sir.
But the law will not allow it, Pompey. Nor shall it not be allowed in Vienna.
Does your worship mean to geld and splay all the youth of the city?
No, Pompey.
Truly, sir, in my poor opinion, they will to it then. If your worship will take order for the drabs and the knaves, you need not fear the bawds.
There are pretty orders beginning, I can tell you. It is but heading and hanging.
If you head and hang all that offend that way, but for 10 year together, you'll be glad to give out a commission for more heads. If this law hold in Vienna 10 year, I'll rent the fairest house in it after 3 pence a day. If you live to see this come to pass, say Pompey told you so.
Thank you, good Pompey. I need requital of your prophecy. Hark you. I advise you, let me not find you before me again in any complaint whatsoever. No, not for dwelling where you do. If I do, Pompey, I shall beat you to your tent and prove a shrewd Caesar to you. In plain dealing, Pompey, I shall have you whipped. So, for this time, Pompey, fare you well.
I thank your worship for your good counsel, but I shall follow it as the flesh and fortune shall better determine. Whip me, no, let Carmen whip his jade, the valiant's heart not whipped out of his grate. The line that I like here, thank you very much, Matt. The line that I like here, and again, this which seems to be a real biting satire on the society of the day, and on our society as well. Does your worship mean to geld and splay all the youth of the city. Mm-hmm. The law will not allow prostitution, and it will not be allowed in Vienna, Aeschylus says. And he says, well, does your worship mean to geld and splay all the youth in the city? You know, this is a play essentially about the containment of moral values, and the point is that they can't be contained. Shakespeare, the clown here, like in many clowns in Shakespeare, speaks the truth even though it's his own skewed perspective on it. We can sort of see a truth in this. And this is a real problematic play too, in that the Duke, rather than controlling the moral decay of the city, he takes it upon himself to appoint a strict Puritan justice. And it's under the guise of this strict justice that they're doing this moral sweep and trying to get rid of the bawds. You know, the Duke doesn't take any responsibility for this, and he wants to come in at the end and sort of save the city from this strictness. You know, what sort of a Duke, what sort of a leader has this responsibility that he wants to turn it over to someone else and then come in to be more lenient or to look well in comparison? It's a real problematic figure.
Was this written during...
This one is probably around 1600 or so, about the same time in Hamlet. Yeah.
Maybe it's a critique, Greg, of legalism that wants to celebrate grace.
Well, yeah. We're about out of time. I want to close with a report from the, as promised, the Clarence Thomas Shakespeare Festival. Just to see how well, you know, your own senators know what's in Shakespeare. My contention is that at least through some of the scenes that we've seen today, that Shakespeare, even though he is this cultural icon, would not pass the Bob Dole test if he only knew what was in it. and here my point is that I'm not so sure that the members of our U.S. Senate do know what is in Shakespeare. This is an article by Barry Adelstein. It was in the New Republic in November, in 1991, and it's entitled Mech Bluff. This is about love and hate and cheating and distrust and kindness and disgust and avarice and jealousy and envy. Joan Collins on the return of Dynasty, Geraldo on the cheerleader mom. Actually, it's Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming describing the Clarence Thomas confirmation battle. Summing it up in one phrase, he declaimed, in short, it's all Shakespeare. Dusting off their copies of the complete works, members of the Judiciary Committee and their witnesses spoke the bard's lines trippingly on the tongue. They quoted whole speeches and small fragments, summarized, paraphrased, and plagiarized. When the quotations weren't entirely inappropriate, they were just dumb. The ironies piled up faster than Coke cans outside the EEOC. It was the context that foiled most of them. Simpson's recourse to Othello was one of the most incongruous. He intoned, quote, good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse steals trash, tis something, nothing, twas mine, tis his, and has been a slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed. Simpson added, what a tragedy, what a disgusting tragedy. Midway through this dramatic reading, the senator admonished his audience to remember this scene. Had he done so himself, Simpson would have realized that these lines were spoken by Iago, a white man who, although supposedly on Othello's side, plots to bring him down and eventually destroys him. A few scenes earlier, this alienated psychopath exclaims twice, I hate the Moor, I hate the Moor. And he also responds to the charge, thou art a villain, with, you, sir, are a senator. As if this weren't enough, remember that Othello is a black man who holds a high position in a white society and who endures endless derision for marrying a white woman. No wonder Judge Thomas, along with every other literate American, sat there silent. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont offered this gem in the floor debate. Judge Thomas doth protest too much. When Gertrude speaks this line in Hamlet, criticizing the player queen's excessive protestation, it is an ironic sign to the audience that she herself is guilty. Are you trying to tell us something, Senator? Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, for his part, wrongly attributed to Shakespeare a quotation from the Restoration dramatist William Congreve. Questioning the first panel of pro-Thomas witnesses, Biden tried to find out whether Professor Hill was really basically the woman scorned in the way that Shakespeare used the phrase, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." Later that day, Simpson set the chair straight. Heaven has no rage to love like love to hatred turned, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned, which is from Congreve's The Mourning Bride. Biden admitted for the record that he was wrong and joked, "Not that I would ever think Mr. Congreve would plagiarize Shakespeare." Wrong again, Senator. Congreve's works are crammed with borrowings from Shakespeare, none attributed. Consult Neil Kinnock. The fact that this came from Joe Biden, I just think is phenomenal. But no one surpassed Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia. Arguing that Thomas was wrong to blame the process for his troubles, Byrd quoted Cassius and Edmund, who mocked those who blame the stars for the problems of their own making. "It is unfortunate that both of these characters are murderous manipulators and dead before their plays end, but the context never slowed Byrd." His 2 hours traffic of our Senate floor included references not only to Julius Caesar and King Lear, but also to the Bible, Genesis and Psalms, Milton's Paradise Lost, Old English Law, the Constitution, Procopius, and the Washington Post. He even repeated Congreve's line, "Women scorn" tag, but at least he didn't attribute it to Joe Biden. The real tragedy was the missed opportunities. Had she testified, Angela Wright might have revealed this glimpse behind the doors, the closed doors of Thomas's office. This is from Ben Jonson's The Alchemist. Surely he had got some bawdy pictures, the friar and the nun, or the boy of 6-year-old with the great thing. Some may ask, what's this but libeling against the Senate? Indeed, the legislators have far graver matters at hand than the incisive quoting of Shakespeare, but it remains true that they have been at the grace feast of language and stolen the scraps. And they missed the main course, the Clarence Thomas who actually exists in Shakespeare. A little ingenuity among Senate aides would have unearthed Thomas of Clarence, the younger brother to Henry V. He has little of substance to say, of course, but that makes him all the more appropriate. Thank you for coming.